Welcome to the One Last Sketch Podcast, the show dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and history. I'm your host, Michael Wojcik. Today I'm joined by two of my friends, regulars on this podcast.
Corey.
And Marie Goshmarack.
This is episode 17, and today we're talking about A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller Jr. Canticle for Leibowitz was published in 1959 for the first time. It was initially published as three short stories, or actually novellas, in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. They were later expanded into this book and tied together a bit better than in their original versions. It is a post-apocalyptic novel, which, spoilers, becomes an apocalyptic novel, which is one of the main themes of it, which is probably going to make up the bulk of how we're going to discuss this book tonight.
I would imagine, yeah.
Unlike the usual for our podcasting endeavors, we're drinking tea this time instead of alcohol, so maybe we'll be a bit more coherent.
Yeah, and we're all in the same room. Again!
So, first I guess we'll talk about what drew us towards reading this novel in the first place, or the circumstances towards it. I had actually avoided this novel for a long time, mainly due to the cover of the small paperback edition that was in the library, where I thought that this was about a monastery that got visited by aliens, which is not the plot at all, but it's not helped that those particular year's editions didn't really have any information about the book on the back cover beyond quotes praising it. When I did actually learn about it or hear about it in a different context as a post-apocalyptic novel, that's when I bought it and read it in that format, thus dispelling my initial impressions.
I became acquainted with it when, in university, I had a professor actually reference it in class. We weren't reading the book, but he kind of talked about it, told a brief bit of the summary and some of the humor in it. And that kind of stuck with me. And then just a few years later, it was floating around in the back of my head, and I decided to look for it and actually read it. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm working through Corey's bookshelf.
I think both of us browbeat you into reading this one, too.
Browbeating wasn't required, because this was a book that, from the premise of what you told me, and as you were reading it, I was interested in it. It was just finally getting the time and the mood to approach it.
So, as mentioned in the introduction, this is not a single continuous novel. It's actually three novellas. They're connected together that chronicle life in the Leibowitz Abbey over the course of about 1,200 years. Each of the three novellas is titled in Latin. First one's Fiat Homo, second's Fiat Lux, third is Fiat Voluntas Tua, and we'll have Marie translate those right now.
Oh, that's not fair! hang on. Fiat Homo is... Yeah, Fiat is, I think, to make man is made. Fiat Lux is light is made.
Let there be man, let there be light.
Yeah. And then Voluntas Tua, Wallo Valera, I think that's to go out. Let there go out. But I'm getting my Latin-English dictionary! God damn it, that was me!
But I'm going to keep on recording, because why not?
I'm going to check that bit first. Listen, listeners, this is what translating Latin is like live. Fiat is so be it. Yeah, so be man would be, and so be light would be kind of the thing there. And then, voluntas, tas is will, wish, desire. So be your wish, I think. You can say this. Your will, wish, desire, purpose, aim, intention, inclination, goodwill, sympathy, willingness, approval, choice, option, last will and testament, attitude, meaning. So that's from the New College Latin and English Dictionary, which I recommend for anyone studying Latin. It's pretty good.
So the book chronicles this abbey, which is the home of the Albertian Order of St. Leibowitz, who is not a saint in the first novella. At the outset, a novice called Francis, named Francis, discovers a remain of Leibowitz's scientific work, because he was a scientist before he became a monk. This is already a few hundred years after the nuclear war has happened, what appears to be in the early 70s, from what I could tell, even if this book, the main portions of it, were published in the 50s. Afterwards, there was something called the Great Simplification, where people got really annoyed at scientists and decided to destroy all scientific knowledge. But thankfully, Leibowitz started this group of monks who would try and save books and memorize books and retain this knowledge. A lot of it is still lost because a lot of them were tortured. At this point, they only have a few fragments within their monastery, but Francis uncovers what is a bunker, a fallout shelter. Unfortunately, everybody who was in it died because there was a cave-in that sealed them all in. And he is able to discover electrical plans and a bunch of other stuff that will influence the course of history for this monastery for the next 1,000 and so years.
Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a while since I've read this, but the Great Simplification, the reason for it in the story is basically people see science bringing us the atomic bomb and nuclear war, so the simplification is basically rebellion against science, because in their perception it's brought nothing but misery.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And it's basically, it's anti-intellectualism run rampant. Anything that is knowledge or is perceived as being smart is deemed evil and must be cleansed, effectively.
Yeah, the mob.
Yeah, and that's all backstory to where the book starts.
I'd like to add that Francis is my favorite character in the entire book. He's funny on many levels.
Not very smart.
Nope. But still with a dedication to... I'm not exactly sure what he's dedicated to, but with a single-minded dedication that I appreciate.
Yeah, this book is surprisingly humorous for a chronicle of the post-apocalypse.
Mm-hmm. And full of Latin. For those of you who...
Well, the language they're supposedly speaking is a combination of Latin and future English in general. And then in the monastery itself, they're still preserving Church Latin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple jokes. I think Francis in particular goes through them about having trouble translating ancient English, which would be modern English as we speak it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of pieces where if you understand Latin at all, it's fun to go through. I didn't actually read it with my Latin English dictionary. I felt this, from the beginning, this was going to be a book I was going to reread. But there's some of the simpler sentences, it's easy to tell what they're saying. These constructions are not too hard.
Yes, and for a science fiction novel, this reads very much like a historical novel in terms of what it's covering and its approach to the material.
I think that's kind of the point, though. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we will be getting to the cyclical nature of history in Canticle for Leibowitz later.
Mm-hmm.
But the first part would be roughly equivalent to about Europe shortly after the fall of Rome.
Like around 600, 800?
Yeah, 400 or 500 AD.
I think that's very much an intentional parallel, because with the fall of the Roman Empire, monasteries are where a lot of Roman knowledge was actually preserved, because much of it was lost, but monks were able to keep their hands on some texts, and they kept recopying them until the Renaissance.
Although we do need to be careful that not everything was lost completely at that time. There was a lack of less knowledge, but I think overall people retained a decent amount. And in some cases, I think it's surprising the amount retained from this post-apocalypse world as well, partly from the work of the... Are they bookleggers? Is that what they're called?
They're called bookleggers.
They're called bookleggers.
Because they conceal books in kegs. This is the case where they're not concealing alcohol. Mm-hmm. They're concealing books in cases meant for alcohol.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I'll give it
Which,
that.
Again, a little revelation for those of you who haven't read this about the humor in the book.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite jokes in the book is, again, near the beginning when Francis discovers the fallout shelter. At the point the story picks up, fallout has kind of fallen into myth. People talk about the fallout as this great cataclysmic day, but for them, fallout is this evil, world-destroying demon. So when he finds the fallout shelter, he thinks it's a shelter for sheltering fallouts, or these demons. And it says it has a capacity for, I think, like 12. And he's aghast, because one fallout ruined the world, so heaven knows what 12 of them can do.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we as a modern audience know what nuclear fallout is. I mean, it's a very morbid joke, but I laughed quite a bit at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if we're a modern audience. We're the audience in the past, for Francis.
That's true.
So...
So the second part of this novel takes place in a period that would roughly be about 1600 in the European timeline in our past.
Yeah.
And the third part takes place in what would be our future.
Yeah.
Of course, our future is being cut off by a nuclear bomb in Canticle for Leibowitz. Humans have developed starships and are starting to colonize nearby planetary systems, but unfortunately haven't learned that much.
No.
From their predecessors. And in fact, there's already rumors going on or theories happening in that Renaissance portion that maybe the past wasn't documented properly and the great simplification never actually happened.
There's a great tension between the abbot figure, I can't remember his name in the second part, and an intellectual figure who's supposed to be like an up-and-coming person from the newly now establishing university type system.
Well, each of the three parts is structured around a dialogue between one or more characters.
Yeah.
The first one, a good portion of it, is not only Francis talking to the abbot, but also Francis talking to the committees that are investigating whether Leibowitz is going to achieve sainthood. Because at this point, he's being beatified, but he's not a saint yet. The second part involves a debate between the abbot and the scientist that Marie mentioned.
Yeah.
And the third part involves a debate between another abbot and a doctor who's working for the government in what are essentially euthanasia chambers that they're setting up for people suffering from radiation poisoning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll touch on this a little more as we go through, but one thing I liked about this book is it's very commonly dismissed as being pro-religion or pro-Catholic or however you'd like to describe it. I think it's worth noting it's not specifically anti-Catholic or anti-religion, but I don't think it's pro either. It simply looks at the role religion has had at different phases in human history.
I guess it's worth noting at this point that Walter Miller was Catholic.
Yeah. Oh, he's very Catholic.
Yeah.
And it's a very Catholic setup, but I feel like it does become more of a backdrop than the actual sort of driver of what's happening. Mm-hmm. Other than the fact that it's a monastery system set up quintessentially like it has been in our history, too. It's I get this sort of atheistic feel in some ways from the practicality of running the abbey from each abbot that comes through, because even though they have a religious part of them, that's just sort of like their background culture, as it were, and what they actually do towards knowledge is not necessarily driven by religion. So I'd say that you could read it as something that isn't necessarily pro-Catholic.
Yeah, and despite that seeming atheistic bent, there are supernatural elements in this novel in that the only recurring character between these three parts is, in one part, Benjamin Eleazar, in another part, Lazarus, who is the actual Lazarus raised by Jesus, who remains a Jew and wanders the world for thousands and thousands of years, shaking his head.
Also very funny.
Mm-hmm.
Will probably also survive the plot ending feature.
Funny in a very dark way. Like, I found the characters very funny in a court jester kind of way, in that it's their job to make you laugh, but he's also laughing at your foolishness. In there's kind of the, I think, the implicit assumption that we as the readers are very much part of this world.
He also kicks off the plot in that he shows Francis the stone, which when Francis moves it, will reveal the fallout shelter.
Francis believes him to be Leibowitz himself.
Saint Leibowitz,
yeah. Which I'm sure Benjamin thinks is funny later on. I think in the second half he's just sort of hanging out on a... because he's playing gambling with the poet on a hilltop.
Mumbly pig.
Yeah, he's just hanging out there next to the abbey, and I don't remember really where he doesn't show up very long in the third part, I don't think.
In the third part, he's mentioned as being one of the homeless people receiving meals at the abbey. And that's where I remember him there. I don't know if he has much more of a role.
I think that's the only place where he shows up.
Yeah.
However, there is another supernatural event that happens near the end, but we're not sure if that's something that's actually happened or a hallucination on the part of the dying abbot.
Describe.
Well, there's a two-headed woman.
Yep.
But one of her heads, she's an old woman. Her other head seems to be a young baby who's dormant. And then she gets killed and the other head awakes. Mm-hmm. And the abbot thinks that the other head is the rebirth of Jesus or something to that effect.
Yeah. Something like that.
He is seeing the return of the Messiah or a Messiah.
And I think that her body gets up and walks off, too.
Yeah.
So.
Right. I know that probably our favorite parts are going to be in the first book.
Yeah.
I found the first section to be probably the most interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the most morally and emotionally affecting is probably part three.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I think there are definitely some interesting comments in part three as well.
I thought part two had the best dialogue between two people, because mm-hmm, it was ongoing and fervent.
Which is what we're coming to,
yeah.
Because despite the fact that we probably favor part one and part three, I think we need to concentrate on part two, because this seems to be the most clear expression of the argument that's running through this entire book.
We could give part one its treatment and then go through, I guess.
Okay, do we have much more to say about part one?
I think what Francis actually does with his life is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he finds the scientific blueprints, then he makes a work of recopying one of these blueprints and illuminating it as a manuscript, which he then goes to bring to the Neo-Pope or whatever.
In New Rome. He's not the Neo-Pope, he's just the Pope.
He's the Pope in New Rome. I knew there was a new in there somewhere. And it's sort of a wonderful example of people copying things that they don't understand, because he spends a lot of effort making a white sheet blue in general, not only to realize at the end that a blueprint is made as it is just a fact of how it gets copied. It's not like the
cheap reproduction method.
Yeah.
That's what makes him so very disappointed.
And ultimately his illuminated manuscript, which he brought as a gift, is stolen from him by bandits on the way, and some mutated people as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are still mutated people running around at this point after the fallout.
Yeah, it's still within a recent enough memory that radiation hasn't quite gone away, and it's affecting people.
Mm-hmm. People don't live very long in this time period.
Mm-hmm.
This is the portion of the novel that most parallels the Middle Ages, and again, the fall of Rome, and the loss of knowledge, and the defense of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea that Francis does copy out the blueprint by making something completely blue, but when he does find out that the blue was just an accident, as we mentioned, so he actually takes the time to make a fancy illuminated manuscript copy of this blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, just another example of humor, because he's dedicating his life to making this incredibly intricate work of art for something that's just, it's a document, it's a technical document.
It's probably a transistor or something dull.
It's because Leibowitz was an electrical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And these documents predate the nuclear war, and Leibowitz doesn't convert to Catholicism until after the nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth saying why we probably like part one the most, other than the sort of historical feel of it. I think for me what I like about it is the sort of sense of rebuilding, and there's also potential for where humanity can go from that point, where as it gets to a more depressing sort of engagement later on in the book.
See, my reasons for liking it were much less noble. I found it was just the most overtly humorous in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very dark humor, but I enjoyed it just because of how funny it was.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Shall we move on to part two?
Part two.
Sure.
Fiat Lux.
Yes.
Because light is made in the basement.
So this part, as we said before, is primarily a debate between a scholar who is a secular scholar and does not think much of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And actually believes that they've been hiding this knowledge instead of preserving it to be used once
the
world is ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is an overt didactic part to this section, specifically voiced by the poet who wins a goat.
Yep, there's a blue goat.
From Benjamin Eleazar, and then makes the point of wanting to have made a gift to it to Thantadeo, because he says, if there's to be light, then somebody will have to be blamed for the darkness, which forms the crux to the arguments that are going on through this entire section.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out that the character we're referring to as the poet is literally called the poet. I don't think he actually has a name beyond that.
No.
Yeah, that's his function. Nobody really likes him.
No.
The secular scholar, I forget his name again.
Fon Tadeo.
He's not exactly a sympathetic character.
No.
He's obviously a talented genius. On the other hand, he is very talented at theoretical things, but the actual practicalities of experimentation are something he doesn't arrive at easily, which makes him supremely annoyed when he sees that a monk named Kronhauer, I believe that's how you pronounce it, has made a working arc light in the library, has generated electricity without really understanding the theoretical principles that Fon Tadeo has been working on for almost his entire life to this point in the novel.
There's also kind of a little subtle part of Fon Tadeo's character that's mentioned, how he's a genius. And he's not exactly humble. He knows he's a genius. But he's very much infuriated by the fact that he lives in an era where all he can do is rediscover past knowledge instead of finding new knowledge of his own.
I remember in this section that the abbot from this section is, to me, the most interesting of the three abbots in this story. And I think it's because he has this incredible unease going on about what this knowledge means in the end. I think the introduction of Fon Tadeo is making him start to wonder about where knowledge can bring people and what this stuff they've been sitting on for so long means, because he has an interesting kind of vision as well at one point, which I don't entirely remember, but he's sitting in his office and the statue, which looks, I think, quite a bit like Eleazar, which is made in the first section, also kind of speaks, not specifically speaks to him, but works on him. And also, though he's an acerbic and very practical kind of, I have to run a monastery and make sure it doesn't get murdered by a large group of people kind of person. So.
Because in the background of all this, there is a war about to start at the beginning of this section, and then has already begun by the end.
Yeah, that's you don't actually see the effects of the war that's mentioned in the second section, though.
Well, it's a little, because we do experience the poet's...
Yeah, the poet dies.
Yeah.
The poet seeing refugees getting slaughtered and coming to a decision that he wants to save the refugees and intercede.
And so he dies.
Yeah. a lot of the main questions are who's going to govern the use of this power that can be derived from studying the memorabilia. A big argument at the beginning is that Fon Tadeo had wanted the monastery to give documents over to his academy. And there's also tension going on between the towns and the monastery, because the towns want to set up a library and put books in it, and they want the books to be moved over from the monastery over there. But this monastic order is specifically tasked with preserving and defending the memorabilia and keeping it.
I love how it's called the memorabilia. It's very funny.
Well, again, it is a very interesting kind of dichotomy. It's, okay, where does knowledge belong? Who should have it? What does responsibility mean? Who is responsible? Like, there's a lot of questions asked in this section, and I think they're very important ones. And again, for me, this is where I see kind of the novel actually being quite secular. It's not that the novel specifically argues that the church should have it. It's that those characters believe it's their job.
Now, as for Fon Tadeo, his answer to the abbot's questions concerning how this... Are we actually going to let this fall into the hands of this despotic ruler who's apparently illiterate, but who still wants to control scientific knowledge and the patronage of universities and so on? And Fon Tadeo answers, if you try to save wisdom until the world is wise, Father, the world will never have it.
Which is kind of true and sort of unfortunate, but I can see why someone being conservative, because as an abbot, I think you're automatically conservative. You'd want to keep holding on to wait until the world is ready, but then you might be waiting forever. But maybe waiting forever would be good for people, as we might see in a future section.
So these are all high-minded things we've been talking about so far, but I think we should get to an overt didactic portion of this, in that a lot of the standard historical narrative that you would receive in high schools at this time was that the Catholic Church had plunged the world in, or plunged Europe into darkness and caused the Dark Ages through strict control of information and destroying past sources of knowledge, which is what Fon Taddeo believes, and he's not set up as a great guy.
I think it's a good point, though, because, again, the Catholic Church is accused of a lot of things during the period of the Middle Ages, and I'm not what would be called necessarily sympathetic towards them, but they are accused of a lot of things that they didn't actually do. The Church didn't have the Orwellian control that the modern narrative claims. I mean, it had power, but it certainly wasn't all-powerful. And it certainly did actually try to preserve knowledge, not just to destroy it. I mean, yeah, there might have been individual monks, but they would have been considered insane.
It does make you question, though, if just holding on to knowledge is withholding knowledge as well. So
I think in some ways it could be considered to be withholding it, yeah. I mean,
because they don't necessarily say that they're going to copy out books for this library or anything. That's kind of not on for them to spend effort, I think, in this section.
Well, part of it, too, is knowledge is useless if it's not shared, right? So they may think that they're doing something good by preserving it and holding on to it, but the perspective of the secular characters is that they're doing something bad because they're depriving them of something that's potentially useful. And I think it's a fair point for the secular characters to have.
Mm-hmm. What's nice about this book is that the people are written as quite nicely real, rounded characters, but also that they all have good points in their arguments.
Mm-hmm. Because if we go back to the historical content that went into making this part, a lot of the problems that were encountered during the Scientific Revolution are not because of biblical teachings that the Catholic Church was trying to enforce. It was old Greek and Greco-Roman scientific theories.
Woo, Galen.
That had been basically reconciled with biblical knowledge over the course of a few hundred to over a thousand years of scholastic arguments that was being defended and frozen.
You can talk about more about that on my website, wonderbexy.com. Anywho.
And that was what was the impediment towards further scientific discovery and inquiry, but not for very long.
Well, what's kind of an interesting point about that is that, like you said, the Greco-Roman scientific knowledge had been aligned with biblical teachings. In a way, the Greco-Roman science was more, if you'll pardon the joke, gospel than the gospels themselves. The issues weren't, like you said, that the scientific knowledge contradicted the Bible, it's that they contradicted the Greeks and the Romans.
It is a rather different situation here, though, in that the scientific knowledge they're preserving is something that hasn't been so much reconciled as they just don't understand it. Well, beyond basic mechanical principles, like certain monks like Kronhauer.
And they're very much at a point in history where they're not capable of understanding it. I mean, there's that whole joke about, or fantasy, whatever you want to call it. I mean, if you could travel back in time to the Middle Ages and take a working computer, it's useless because it's too much of a knowledge jump. You need the steps in between to make more advanced technologies even useful.
Oh yeah, you can plug it in. I'm sorry, I had to say that.
No,
I know what you mean.
Yeah, like all jokes aside, I mean, if you could account for the power source and everything else, I mean, there are too many stages to get you there.
Everyone would kind of look at it and be like, well, why don't I just write this with a pen? Would be the immediate sort of thought. That seems much easier.
So, it ends with Fon Taddeo leaving, but actually making a choice to confiscate the plans that his military attachés were drawing up of the abbey because they want to use it as a strategic defense point. He hides them or gets rid of them before the military attachés have time to redraw. And this act will preserve the abbey in the future, which is an interesting decision on his own part, in that while he still virulently disagrees with a lot of what the abbey stands for and what the abbot stands for, he still ends up respecting the abbot.
I think that he has a certain impression of what could happen if the Abbey wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, again, he doesn't like that the knowledge isn't being shared, but he'd rather not lose it again.
He couldn't make the arc lamp himself. Could be kind of the key thing going on there.
Yep. So, having gone through that section, we move on to the cyclical nature of history in Canticle for Leibowitz by talking about part three.
Yes. Where everything goes to shit again, basically. Yeah.
To sum up, we have advanced further than...
the near future.
Yeah, basically. Further than our predecessors. We're discovering new knowledge and doing things that haven't been done before. Mm-hmm. But we haven't seemed to have learned any of our lessons because this novel ends in a second nuclear war, the memorabilia and the Order of Leibowitz rocketing off into space for Alpha Centauri to set up a new colony and essentially start this process...
Again.
All over again.
Yep.
What I think is interesting there is you mentioned the cyclical nature of history. Yes, it's cyclical in that an apocalypse, time goes on, we get to another apocalypse. But they break the cycle just enough to advance, at least. Because they do get farther than they were before the last apocalypse. They are able to leave. They are able to go out into space. So it's cyclical, and again, that cycle's being repeated in space, but that cycle does eventually have small breaks that let some advance happen.
And going back to my point at the beginning of this podcast, that this reads more like historical fiction, even with its overt scientific elements, is Walter Miller's approach to time seems distinctly medieval. In that this cyclical nature of things repeating but slowly advancing forward, in that in the idea of time there is an end to history in medieval thought. The world will be eventually destroyed in Armageddon.
Eschatology?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But within that timeline, events are constantly repeating and taking place in slightly different forms.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I knew about eschatology. I didn't know it had that repeating part in it there. I think what makes it depressing, though, is that it ends with this claim that humans cannot achieve more faster because ultimately we just destroy ourselves constantly and drag ourselves back from, I'd say you could probably say, baser arguments. is what drives a lot of these wars. Because it's never really clear why the first Armageddon happened, why this one happened. So,
well, it's also because the governments that are involved are doing deliberate obfuscation campaigns so that none of the official news sources can be trusted and any other source of information is cut off. You can't do it. You can't fly anywhere without permits, or at least not without having friends in high places.
Well, I mean, again, this section is very much a parody of the Cold War as well. Like, it's... I mean, the common narrative we're exposed to in the Western world is that, you know, the good capitalist powers versus the evil communist powers. But the fact is, I mean, there were some really crazy people with their fingers on those buttons as well.
And then there's the East and Asia dialogue.
That part I actually find really interesting. Do you mind if I comment on that?
Go ahead.
There's one part. The abbot of this section, there's a doctor who wants to set up a clinic on the monastery grounds, which part of the purpose of this clinic is to provide euthanasia in the event that a nuclear war happens. There's a lot of radiation, a lot of fallout, a lot of people who are going to be dying very slow, horrible, painful deaths, and the point of the clinic, since it can't treat them, is to euthanize them.
It's already active. It's because I think some bombs have been dropped already, so there are some people already exposed to radiation.
It starts out, if I'm remembering correctly, it starts out with preparation for the war, because everyone can see it's coming, and then it does actually happen. And the abbot forbids them from setting up on the monastery grounds. He tells them, no, you go up the road, you can't do it here. And then when the bombs start falling, the abbot goes out and takes a drive, you know, to see if there's anything he can do, to see the people, and he ends up giving this young woman and her child a ride who've been exposed to the fallout. And they're, again, radiation poisoning, very slow, painful deaths. And she asks him, take me to the clinic, because, you know, she wants relief from the pain. And he forbids her, in the name of Christ, to go. Now, in a secular society like ours, that doesn't mean a lot. But what I find interesting there is the perspective of the monk. That is the highest authority he can invoke. Like, that's very much a moment of something he strongly believes in. Those words have weight to him, even if they don't have weight to us or the characters. But I just found it a very touching and very emotional moment. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, the monks aren't portrayed as bad people. They're not portrayed as saints either. They're portrayed as very human characters, and that's, in a way, his human failing that he's got to fall back on that. Mm-hmm. Like, he can't just abandon that belief no matter how horrible things get.
Mm-hmm. Well, and his... the way he's thinking, it's morally wrong for him to just go along with it at any point.
Mm-hmm.
And when he tries to reason with her, she won't listen to him. Mm-hmm. But she does respond to him giving a command, which mm-hmm. is why he's so insistent, because he thinks maybe mm-hmm. he can stop this from happening.
And it's interesting when he's dying at the end, how he kind of thinks on this as well, and kind of has this, I will persevere until the end by self, I wouldn't take an option kind of thing. Although he has moments where he sort of wavers, but he's carries on too.
What it comes down to, and I think this is kind of the inherent nobility of the character, is that he acknowledges what he was asking the young woman to do. He acknowledges the pain he was asking her to suffer. And part of acknowledging that is acknowledging that if he's asking people to do it, he needs to live it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, after the big blow-up, we're left with a severely ambiguous ending
mm-hmm.
on what humanity's future is going to be after this.
Mm-hmm.
In that there are colonies, we've made it to the stars, but these colonies are now cut off from their home world.
Knowledge
which was possibly
lost.
Destroyed entirely.
Mm-hmm.
They have to make it on their own.
Knowledge has again been lost in a large mm-hmm. swath, and there's a small sea that might set up a monastery. If it gets to where it's supposed to go. It's kind of a downer.
Yeah.
Again, it's meant to be, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very... the book's very much a fable. It's very much a commentary on, again, Cold War politics and the attitudes of, you know, mutually assured destruction and all the other crazy things people believed at the time.
Well, and this is why I wanted to get this copy on the table here, because it has this introduction by a Mary Doria Russell, and she makes interesting comment in it that... when this book came out, it was very much a product of its time. But what she's found interesting is that, quote, the Cold War fears kind of faded, but that now, around the time that this book was reprinted, they are somewhat coming back again, because we have fears surrounding North Korea, we have made-up fears of Middle Eastern events going on, and real ones, and that she says is interesting to me, because I remember living... when these things first came around, and then that ghost seemed to go away, and now it's sort of rising again, so this fable's still useful to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, the circumstances have changed, but again, a larger comment on literature, as times change, we reinterpret literature to fit our current context.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was a fable about nuclear paranoia, now it's a fable about paranoia.
Mm-hmm. I think it still could be a fable about nuclear paranoia. It's not like we don't have that ability
no,
anymore.
No, unfortunately, yeah.
I think it works because, unlike some other highly influential and best-selling nuclear-themed post-apocalyptic works from that time, this seems a lot more powerful because it's about other things, too.
Mm-hmm.
The nuclear fears only form a background to a lot of the events that are happening in this novel, and the themes it's exploring are other things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think why this works so well is a lot of post-apocalyptic novels or novels about nuclear fear, it's racing to stop the devastation, and then if they're bleak, the devastation happens and everybody dies, or if they're optimistic, you stop the devastation. This very much shows life beyond the devastation continuing in some form, but it shows how, even though life continues, that is always part of the collective psyche or the collective conscious. People are aware of this. This affects day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, life continues, but the scars remain, if you'll pardon the cheap metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So, we don't have any other complete novels by Walter M. Miller.
Mm.
He wrote, over the course of a decade, quite a few short stories. Even this originally started out as novellas
mm-hmm.
that were later rewritten and tied together. There is indeed a sequel of sorts. It doesn't take place after this. He didn't finish it before he died, though. Mm. It was completed by someone else.
Mm.
Apparently takes place in around the time period of the second part of this book.
Sort of shows that was the driving part, really.
Mm-hmm. I haven't read that, mostly because it's not easy to find.
Mm.
And plus, I think there's because it was completed by someone else.
Yeah.
There might be some divergent bits in it to Walter and Miller's vision.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, for someone who only released this one novel, this has been a massively influential novel, and I don't think it's been out of print since it was first released.
No, I mean, my copy was printed in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's still being printed, still going strong. A lot of people still read it.
Mm-hmm.
I think as long as we live in a world with any form of weapon of mass destruction, this will be relevant. And I mean, actually, no, I'm going to actually rescind that comment. As long as we live in a world where we're capable of wreaking large-scale destruction, this will be relevant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. I'd recommend it to lots of people. And as bleak as now that we spoiled it for you anyway, but as bleak as it sounds, it's not a drag the whole way through. It's definitely a very enjoyable read.
This was a reread for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost feels to me that this is a novel that's more worth rereading.
Mm-hmm.
In that there are a lot of details that you're going to miss the first time around. Mm-hmm. So if you read this once and are listening to this podcast, or twice or three times, maybe you want to read it again.
Bring your new college Latin English teacher.
Yeah, no, again, I agree with you guys. I think it's a very good book. I enjoyed it a lot. I've only read it once so far. I know I'll reread it in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I would agree. I would highly recommend it.
And despite all our praise, it's worth saying that this is an extremely divisive novel.
Mm.
So maybe we're being a little bit rosy. Quite a few people hate this book with a burning passion.
Because of all the churchiness in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well then, go read his Dark Materials.
I am gonna say something that's probably just a slight bit controversial. I think if you're ripping into this book for the religious context, that you're being very short-sighted. I mean, yes, it is set in the monastery. Yes, all of the main characters have some affiliation with the church. But at no point in reading this did I feel like it was cramming a religious message down my throat. I think it was looking at a religious perspective simply because it is another perspective. And as a human perspective, I think it's a valid one.
Mm-hmm.
And just because you disagree with it doesn't mean this book will be offensive to you. Like, again, I'm not what could be called pro-Catholic, but nor am I anti-Catholic. I'm fairly ambivalent, and I found this book very much aligned with that perspective for me.
Yeah, if you're going to be an intelligent reader, you need to appreciate what's context and what is other, and what other messages you can read. Whereas if you just think that the flavor of this book is the sole message of this book, then I'd have to question your intelligence, I'm not going to lie.
On that note,
have a good evening. Thanks for listening. We love you all, of course.
I think, not quite on that note, I think another of the novel's many themes, the evolving role of religion in society is one of them. So you can appreciate it from a secular perspective in that you can see how it's changed and become less relevant from your worldview.
I think it's realistic as well as a thing to keep in mind here. This, if we have an apocalypse, this would be a realistic way for some knowledge to be preserved because it's worked before. There's no reason why that pattern couldn't work again.
That brings our discussion to a conclusion. Thank you for listening to the One Last Sketch podcast. For more episodes, as well as reviews and articles on various sundry topics, you can visit my website, onelastsketch.wordpress.com. Past episodes are also available on iTunes and on Stitcher. If you want to read about some medical stuff, you can go to Marie's blog.
www.iatropexy.wordpress.com. It'll be linked below.
Yes. Once again, thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, recommend it.